Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and co-parents of all ages, this podcast is for you. Introducing in the center ring, the amicable divorce expert, Judith Weigel.
Hello, amicable listeners. Today, we have Matthew Smyrda Esquire back on the show, quickly becoming a program favorite. Because of your charming personality, Matthew, and your considerable knowledge of California law, thank you for coming back.
All right. Thank you, Judy. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, the level of expectation is high now for being charming. So, this is a new series I wanted to start, and I wanted to do something once a month, and it's a series on celebrity divorces. And I wanted to develop it because I think it's a fun learning tool. First of all, who doesn't love celebrities? Well, I love celebrities and their wild and crazy lifestyle choices. Plus, they're rich. Who doesn't love rich? But the rich and famous go through the exact same issues in their divorces as all of us non-celebrities go through, only with bigger numbers. So our featured two divorces today are the most current, Kim and Kanye, and then we'll go to Dr. Dre and Nicole. So let's look at Kim and Kanye first, Matthew. Ready?
Sure.
All right. They do seem to have an amicable divorce, so I think they're perfect to open up the amicable divorce show. They seem very amicable. Stuff just happens. Life got in the way.
Right.
And the issues with them, or the line items they're going to have to deal with are, well, a prenup. Right? Obviously, they have a prenup, you think?
Yeah. They absolutely do. I think they've acknowledged that publicly. So, yes.
Okay, very good.
Yep.
They were successful before they got together, each one in their own rights, and became more successful. So, with the prenup, there had to have been addressed intellectual property, spousal support, division of assets. And let's start with child support first, because I think that's a really important thing. Isn't that the one thing you cannot cover in a prenup?
It's one of the things that you cannot touch in a prenup, at least in the state of California. And the reason for that is the public policy of the state of California doesn't want to allow parents to do anything that could divest the state of having the ability to make sure that a child is cared for financially, which really, theoretically, is the reason why child support exists, to keep the children cared for and off the state's dime, so to speak. And so the public policy behind it is you can't do anything that really affects or abridges the court's ability to make orders regarding child support. So in practice, we don't touch it in prenups, and we actually specifically usually include language that says this in no way affects any court's ability to issue any orders regarding child support. And the other area actually is child custody as well. You can't plan for what the legal custody will be, joint legal or sole legal custody, nor can you plan for the timeshare for the physical custody of the children you may have. Whether they're born or not at the time you're getting married and signing the prenup, you just can't do it for the same reasons that the court doesn't want to lose its ability to make sure these kids are cared for. So,
understandable. So in the world of child support, and we're dealing with very wealthy people,
yeah.
How have you seen people of that level of wealth deal with child support?
Well, you know, it actually is kind of an interesting thing. I have a case right now where this is a big issue. It actually circles back to what's called the high earner doctrine or the reasonable needs doctrine in California. And without getting too technical, basically what that means is when you, the algebraic formula that exists to calculate child support, it kind of breaks down once you get to a high level of income, because the way it's structured, there's no relative costs of, you know, tuition for a private school. You pay the certain amount of tuition regardless of whether you make $100 million a year or $1,000 a year. You can only buy so many groceries from Whole Foods. You can only, you know, have so many of these affluent lifestyle things. And when you start getting into the spectrum of people who make, you know, $10 million a month or whatever it might be, that formula breaks down and it becomes impractical. So that's where this doctrine came in. It's called, like I said, the reasonable needs or the high earner doctrine. And what it basically says is that the court, well, the way it works is this. So either the parties have to agree or the court has to first calculate a guideline number, meaning use the algebraic formula to show the high number of child support. And then from there, the court actually can deviate downwards to a lower number to figure out, well, what do these children reasonably need? And it's hard to use those terms because we're not talking about what your average kids need, which might be, you know, some groceries from Vons and some clothes from Target and some shoes from, you know, Payless. We're not talking about that. We're talking about reasonable under the circumstances. So you start, it actually completely changes the game of the litigation because normally in most support cases, it's about the income numbers. How do we get to the guideline? But this actually becomes different. It's, well, what is the lifestyle? What are the expenses? What are the things happening with dad or mom, assuming they're opposite gender parents? What's happening with dad or mom? What's the dichotomy between the lifestyles? You know, is dad taking them on private jets? And is dad expensing that through the business? Is dad, you know, taking them to Sundance and Cannes and, you know, all these fun places, you know, whether it's business or not? Does he have a car for the nannies? Do the nannies have their own car? If they have a car, do they each have their own car? Is it a Range Rover? You know, you get into these details. Are they spending $1,000 for birthday presents for their friends? You get into the lifestyle that's unlike anything that most of us live. You know, a lifestyle where it wouldn't be unreasonable to have a Brazilian blowout for a teenage daughter three times a week at the house, you know? Just things like that are just.
I just want to be their children. All of a sudden, adopt me, please. Okay, this is really interesting because I have not dealt on that level. The highest earning couple that I dealt with in my practice in mediation and filing, $25 million. And it was the easiest divorce ever. He said, I can always make money, just split it down the middle, done.
Right.
That was easy. Okay, but so back with this, though.
Yeah.
Do you think, and this is just supposition, mm-hmm. do you think that on this level mm-hmm. of wealth, that there's even a child support payment at all?
Probably not. That's exactly where I was going to go with it. I think that, you know, one of the benefits when you have two very successful and financially independent parents is neither is counting on the other for their livelihood. You know, and so, you know, again, I'm not on this case. I don't know what their real details are, but I think we can all just look from the outside and see nobody's going hungry. Nobody's want for anything. They both have significant income and resources at their disposal. So most likely it's the kind of deal where each child's needs will be paid for when they're in the care of the parent. And there is no actual support payment from either party to the other. And, you know, one thing I wanted to say was, you know, the reason why this is probably so amicable is actually for a number of reasons. Number one, this has probably been negotiated for at least the last 6 to 8 months secretly. The deal was probably made when the filing happened. That's a move that the attorneys involved in this case and in the Dr. Dre case often will try and do, that they'll reach a deal before the public ever finds out. And that's because both parties have financial interests in their public image and their public persona, and going through a divorce, nasty custody battle can be bad for business, you know? And so Laura Wasser, who's the attorney handling it on Kim's behalf, she's notorious for her confidentiality and being secretive. And one of the methods that she utilizes is negotiating the deal before anything is filed often. So that's probably why where they're at now is so amicable. And that's probably why it wasn't so amicable months ago. When they were living separate and apart and they were going at each other on social media.
Right. I remember that.
Probably when the real negotiation was happening, to be honest.
Because there is a public apology by Kanye
right.
that he was, and I want to get into mental health issues and custody sure. in a second,
sure.
our co-parenting, but he was going through, he said, a bipolar episode mm-hmm. and apologized publicly on Twitter to Kim.
Yeah.
And you just mentioned about public image affecting their businesses and their related business deals.
Right.
And of course, TMZ is my Bible when I'm reporting on celebrity divorces to this audience.
Right.
But Gap and Adidas are the two companies that are branding companies for Kanye, and they amped up. It's in this report, they said they were fine. And so I guess, but everybody was conscious probably of that.
So in a case like this, there's a couple other things you'd expect to see. Number one, you'd expect to see what's called a confidentiality agreement and a protective order. Those are documents that would be done by agreement between the parties and attorneys that would essentially bar the disclosure publicly of sensitive information such as trade secrets, dealings with these public companies, things like that from ending up in the court file where TMZ could pull them. So usually people are united in that issue because, again, it doesn't really help anybody for those details to get out. And they're kind of common in any sort of high asset case. We generally use a protective order and confidentiality agreement. And number two, TMZ and the media probably will never know the details of how this divorce actually is being hashed out, which is different than the other, 99% of people that go through a divorce. The average person goes through a divorce, their judgment, which is the final document, whether it's from a trial or it's by settlement, gets filed with the court. And that's a publicly available document. It's a document that if anybody were to go and pull, they can find out, okay, who got the Bank of America account, who got the Volvo, who got the retirement account, how much is being split. All that information is set forth. And we don't generally see that for celebrities that have gone through divorces. And you may ask yourself, well, why is that? Well, there's a technique that you use when you want to maintain that confidentiality. And I call it, for lack of better description, the bare bones judgment. So what gets filed with the court is a quote unquote bare bones judgment that just basically says these folks are divorced, these are their children, and all other orders pertaining to child custody, child support, spousal support, division of assets are in a separate stipulation for settlement that's not being filed with the court. That stipulation is not going to be filed with the court unless and until there's a problem enforcing it. So there's trust on both sides here, but it keeps all the details out of the public. So we don't know who's getting the, X number of shares in the Yeezy brand or the home in Calabasas or whatever. We won't know that unless and until there's a problem. And then I'll tell you this. So in the cases I've had where I've come in where the judgment's not publicly filed, let's say we want to modify child support later down the line, we have to file that document. I have, within the last 2 years, I had a case where the document was confidential. There was a procedure for how to file it. I followed the procedure. And I received a letter from another law firm threatening to sue me personally if I filed that judgment. So I had to file it completely redacted, but for the one little thing that we were trying to change. So people guard that privacy, very tightly. And I'm sure that everybody involved has signed off on any kind of non-disclosure agreements that exist under the sun that impose serious financial penalties for breaking that confidentiality.
Well, Matthew, then, where is that larger document kept if it's not filed?
In the lawyer's offices. It's not in the public record. It's not filed under seal. It's not given to the court. It's just, it exists. It's a binding document under California Code of Civil Procedure 664.6. There's lots of language in there saying that. The orders are effective forthwith, but they're not publicly available for confidentiality reasons.
Okay, so when the average person is mortified over the idea that, A, people can go to a public website and at least see a court, a case profile, you can't really open the documents. There are some people that don't even want people to know they're even divorced.
Right.
And they ask, can't this be done confidential, and you do have to have the court's approval for that?
You do.
Right?
If you want your legal marital status to be dissolved and change from married to single, you have to have a court order doing it. Whether you agree on it or not, you have to have a court order doing it. But everything else, you can get that bare bones status only judgment with the court reserving jurisdiction on the other issues. Now, the drawback of doing it that way that these high-profile people do is God forbid, people don't follow the orders, you don't have a valid court order that's enforceable. You have to go to court to get it turned into a court order. For example, if somebody were not to follow the custody orders, the child custody schedule, you can't show your secret stipulation to the LAPD and have the LAPD come in and turn the children over.
Right.
That's not gonna happen. But the reason why people aren't afraid of that is when you're at that level, you probably have a private security firm that you work with that has capabilities beyond what the LAPD is capable of doing.
So, oh my.
So, you know, it's the concerns. It's another example of how the concerns for these folks don't really apply to the rest of us, you know.
In some measure, yes. Yeah. But excellent learning lessons here. All right, let's go to co-parenting when there's a mental health issue with one of the parents, because it is that way with Kanye.
Yeah.
It's bipolar. I guess that is a true statement, right, if it's been in the press. There are plenty of caretakers around, supposedly.
Yeah.
But one of the articles said that he did take the kids with him recently, last few months, with no caretakers, and there was no episode. So in general, when there's a mental health concern with one of the co-parents, what does the other parent have to do or consider or be prepared for in this co-parenting relationship?
Well, it's really tricky. I mean, bipolar disorder is a tough one. Depending on the type of bipolar disorder, you know, the mania can come on really quickly, and it can have really bad effects to it. So, you know, the court's not supposed to hold the fact that somebody has mental illness against the parent unless there's a danger to the child, making it such that it's not in their best interest. So as long as a parent is, you know, seeing a psychiatrist or getting appropriate treatment, taking medication, their rights are not going to be affected, but normally you would expect to see something that in the paperwork that indicates that the other parent who doesn't have a mental illness can come in ex parte and ask for emergency orders if they have enough evidence showing that the parent's going through some kind of, you know, mental episode or whatever it might be. But it makes it difficult. I mean, you know, and in this particular family, I mean, like you pointed out, which you see in a lot of these cases where there are allegations, whether it be mental abuse, substance abuse, physical abuse, whatever it is, when you have, you know, call them nannies or child care providers who are there 24/7, it kind of insulates the person from those arguments in a way different than most other people would be, because you have these professionals who are there to care for the children, who are sober, who are accountable, making sure the kids' needs are met. It doesn't make it as dangerous having a dad who might, you know, be a drunk or a drug addict or, you know, mentally ill, as long as the kids are safe. You know, you might have prohibitions like the father can't drive the children, or the father may have to, if there's an alcohol issue, father may have to test using SoberLink or something like that before the visits. But, you know, realistically, it's going to get a lot of leeway. You know, it's almost like you call it the Charlie Sheen defense, if you remember back.
Yes,
you know,
I do.
9 or 10 years ago, when he, you know, was going through all that crazy stuff, guy had multiple nannies there, and so he was still seeing his kids, you know?
Right.
So, you know, it's just an example of the different way of life, I guess, in that stratosphere.
And then lastly, this is something that comes up every now and then with me, and I don't know about you, but private judge as an option.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that? What is a private judge?
Yeah.
You get one.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there's a private judge generally refers to a man or a woman who served on the bench in the court publicly and then retired and now is offering their services in a private alternative dispute resolution capacity. And so there in Los Angeles, for example, there are a number of known companies that these judges go work for that provide them with, you know, the office space and the staff and all of that. And they charge for their services in the same way that lawyers do, usually by the hour with a retainer. And, you know, they're very good ones. For example, you know, the former presiding judge of the Los Angeles Superior Court, Thomas Trent Lewis, just retired and now is offering his services as a private judge. You know, the same with his predecessor, Hank Goldberg. He's been doing it for a long time, as well as many other judges, you know, Judge Roy Paul, Judge Scott Gordon, all these people that have been on the bench for a long time that then retire and then want to still be involved and help. And so what they can do to answer your questions, they can do a number of different things. The threshold question is whether are they going to have binding authority or non-binding authority. And what the difference is if they have non-binding authority, really they're acting, doing the same thing that you do, Judy, which is being a mediator. They're helping people bridge the gap and reach an agreement with one another without having the power to make any binding orders or decisions or anything like that, that someone might not be agreeable to. They're trying to make a deal, right?
Right.
That's a very common use of retired judges. And the reason why is because, you know, they've seen a lot. I mean, they, you know, their experience on the bench, they can say, hey, you know, I had this case, I had that case, and I tried this issue, and this is how I, this is my thought process. They give you a look behind the robe, so to speak. And they give you a more, you know, humane way of saying, well, you know, and even though I was making a decision, it could have easily gone that way. It could have easily gone this way. It helps people settle, you know.
But they also file paperwork too, don't they? Private judges.
Well, that's more in the bind. That's in the binding capacity. So let me.
In
the non-binding capacity, they might help you reach, you know, type out a deal memo or something, but they're not going to file the judgment. That would be up to the lawyers involved. But yes, so in the binding capacity, yes, they do. In a binding capacity, here's kind of the theory behind it. If I'm getting too academic, I apologize. But so the California Constitution actually allows for court cases to be handled by someone who used to be a judicial officer, a former judicial officer. And so under this section of the California Constitution, if both parties agree, then they can submit their case to a private judge, meaning it gets taken out of the courtroom where it's assigned at the Stanley Moss Courthouse, for example, and given to this judge who works for one of the private companies. And then at that point, the judge has the exact same decision-making power that the judge would that's sitting in the Stanley Moss Courthouse. They have the ability to take hearings, take evidence, conduct trials, issue rulings, and in that capacity, they would likely generate things like orders after hearing or minute orders, statements of decision, things like that, where they would make rulings. And so basically what you're doing, why they call it a private judge or a rented judge, is you're basically like renting a judge to handle your case. And the reason why people like that, particularly celebrities, is because the trial now happens in a private conference room in Century City, as opposed to the public courthouse where the media can go. So you're buying yourself privacy. And two, generally speaking, these judges are going to be available faster and for more hours than the public court because, you know, for example, the public court is a government agency. They have to only work from 8:30 to 12 with a mandatory 15-minute break, an hour and a half break for lunch from 12 to 1:30, then from 1:30 to 4:30 with, again, a 15-minute break, hard stop at 4:30. That's not as much time as a private judge who could, in theory, if they're willing, work straight from 8 a.m. till midnight, you know, handling a case. So you get a premium service by having a private judge. And there's some other things, I won't get too technical, things like discovery referee or special master or things like that, but ways you can have a judge, you know, have certain kinds of binding authority that's not actually sitting on the bench.
And so anybody can really hire a private judge. You don't have, I mean, what's your kind of, yeah, anybody can. So yeah. Their costs aren't ridiculously expensive, are they?
No, well, I mean, look, you know, you get what you pay for, okay? And so, you know, for example, if you're going to ask someone who is the presiding judge of the family law court to handle your case, they deserve to be paid for their experience because you're getting a premium. So I wouldn't say it's cheap, but I also think that generally speaking, that you get out of it what you pay in because while it may cost you more money to have these folks on board, you're going to get it done faster and you're going to avoid wasting money sitting around in the public courthouse just to get 20 minutes of time when they'll give you 10 hours, you know?
Right. So, and I'm assuming they can fast track all the work that has to be done and then somebody schedules the filing or they schedule the filing if they're a binding judge, right?
Correct.
Okay. Very interesting. And people love that idea of private judge when they have a little extra money and can afford it and are on a time sensitive time issue.
You know what? It's like flying private jet. Same thing.
This takes me away to a whole different life. Okay, so that's Kim and Kanye. We wish them well. It looks like things are going smoothly for them. And I don't think Chris Kardashian would have it any other way, do you?
No, of course. Good for business.
And those kids will probably have careers any day now.
Oh, they'll be fine. Yeah, no one's going to be going hungry. Those kids will be just fine.
All right. Let's now move to Dr. Dre and Nicole.
Sure.
So they're still in the process. They started last year. The issues around their divorce will be prenup, but yes. Missing, I love that part, missing prenup, we'll get to that.
Right.
Spousal support, temporary versus permanent.
Right.
Division of assets / embezzlement.
Yep.
Business embezzlement. Moving out of one of the family residents, possibly affecting community property share or not, and then getting into the residence to get stuff back. So let's start with the prenup. I found this interesting. Now, here's why I find this interesting. I did watch Straight Outta Compton 8,000 times.
That was a good movie.
Yeah. I love that movie. Pardon me?
Great story.
It's a great story. I didn't really understand hip hop and the whole issue with the police being, you know, in right. songs until later on. And certainly that film, because unless you're in those environments, you don't really understand what's going on in other people's lives.
Right.
I found it fascinating. But going back to the prenup, so Nicole is I can't remember. She's either his second wife or he had a child with somebody first and then he married Nicole after that. But they were young.
Yeah.
And he, although he was successful, he wasn't the Dr. Dre we know now.
Right. Nobody thought he'd be a billionaire at that point.
Well, thank you to Jimmy Iovine selling the Beats to Apple, and that will come with embezzlement. Okay, so the missing prenup. Can a prenup really be missing?
Well, sure. I mean, the original copy can be missing, but generally speaking, you know, a good prenup would have a couple of protections against that. Number one, there'd be a clause somewhere in there saying that, you know, photocopies, PDF copies would have the same force and effect as a true original. Okay. And number two, when we sign prenups, this is the reason why we actually sign four originals. We have one for each party and one for each attorney so that if originals get lost, it's just a higher chance of somebody being able to keep it rather than just one copy sitting out there in some vacuum or in a closet somewhere. But no, I mean, as long as there is some kind of reliable document that appears to be a true and correct copy of the agreement, I think that's going to be a really tough sell. Now, I will say this. I don't know, and I don't know if they've alleged it or not. I don't know if the allegation is there that she didn't sign it. I think she's alleging she signed it under duress. She didn't get disclosure, all of those things. But I don't think she's saying, hey, that's not my signature on the paper, right?
Right.
Because if she was, that's still, there are actually folks that do this. They're called forensic handwriting examiners. And they're these PhD people that know the science of analyzing penmanship and pen markings and depth and all of that. And you actually have to bring folks like that into the case to testify whether it's a true and correct signature of the person. And there's all kinds of things. So I don't think they're going that way. And if they're not going that way, then, you know, presumably she can say, hey, oh, that's my signature and it's a true and correct copy. So it's probably not going to get very far.
I don't think it's going to get very far because that was one of the very first reports. And then I pulled down all the subsequent reports and there's no mention of a prenup anymore. So I'm kind of thinking there wasn't and they were too young for that and in love and we'll share everything.
Sure.
Maybe a postnup, maybe, who knows?
Well, I mean,
maybe not.
If you couldn't, you know, if you were Dr. Dre, it's probably in your best interest to have a prenup. Your outcome is probably significantly better with a prenup than without it. If you can't furnish a copy of it and she says under penalty of perjury, she doesn't have a copy of it. And you can't track down either of the lawyers that were involved and you can't produce it. I mean, you're out of luck at that point. If you can't provide a copy of the prenup from somewhere, you can't just say, oh, yeah, we signed a prenup and it said XYZ. Well, where's the document, sir?
Well, you know what? Eazy-E may have done the prenup and he's not around, unfortunately, anymore.
There you go.
Okay. Now, spousal support. Now, this is interesting because what most people may not know is there is temporary spousal support and permanent spousal support.
That's right. That's right.
So here's one article, if I may read some excerpts from it, on temporary versus permanent. She was asking for $2 million a month in temporary.
Well, that's it.
Oh, no, there's plus. I haven't finished.
Yeah.
The court, I'm reading from TMZ.
I know.
The court approved schedule establishing the factors in computing spousal support entitles Nicole to somewhere between $138,622 a month to $81,002 a month. I mean, that's a fairly substantial spread.
Yeah.
Once this case is resolved, Dr. Dre discontinues his current practice of paying for all of her expenses, and he says Nicole is going to have to tighten her belt. So let's stop there for a second.
Sure.
So this is what a lot of people do, right? When you first separate and you're not really involving professionals yet, you're just kind of organizing your lives between you.
Sure.
Money is just spent to keep everybody afloat if they're trying to be amicable, right?
Yep. Correct.
So the higher wage earner will end up paying all the normal bills that they've normally paid and then extra money for the recipient to use for other life expenses, right?
Right.
But then when does permanent kick in? At what point in the process do we go more permanent?
Sure. So everything, I'll put it to you this way, everything before trial is quote unquote temporary, as you used it. The technical term in California, we call it pendente lite, spousal support. It's a Latin phrase. It's just a fancy way of saying, you know, during the pendency of the divorce case. So everything from the moment when somebody files an RFO, request for order, a motion for temporary support, pendente lite support, up until there's a trial, that's the quote unquote temporary support. And that, generally speaking, is a function of the DISO master, just like child support is.
The DISO master, for anybody not in California, is the calculation device that everybody in family law uses for spousal and child support. And I'm sure there's something equivalent around the country in other states.
It would be called universally the statewide guideline for your state, whatever the statewide guideline. And so that number is one thing. And then when you get to trial, generally speaking, that number goes down when it becomes quote unquote permanent. And when you say permanent, really what you're saying is you look at these factors under California Family Code Section 4320, which has a list of a number of things the trial court is supposed to look at and weigh and come up with a number that then becomes the quote unquote permanent support number. Just as a matter of practice and a matter of general experience, it's almost always lower than the temporary number. And so that, I think, is what you're talking about. And then the wide range that exists, again, I don't know about this case, but just in my experience, generally speaking, you have a clash under those factors between the payor, the person who's paying support, saying, hey, I can't sustain this. This is not sustainable. I can't afford it. Versus the recipient saying, hey, my marital standard of living was so affluent that I'm actually entitled to X amount of support. And so the court has to weigh all of this along with anything else. Maybe somebody's disabled. Maybe somebody's been out of the workforce for 20 years. Maybe there's some other unique factor to this. Who knows? But really, that could be the spread, is the numbers versus the lifestyle versus some sort of cap that comes in under the prenup, if there was a prenup, because a lot of prenups have caps on spousal support, or maybe there's a formula in the prenup. Who really knows, you know, because, you know, this is an example of one of those cases where they can't keep it private because they're going at each other. And so the details are leaking out, but I'm sure they have things filed under seal that we can't access. I'm sure they closed the courtroom as much possible, or it's being done remotely these days. So it's really hard to get a full picture beyond what goes in the public file for a case like this.
Well, before we get a little bit more into marital standard of living, I want to finish with where they settled supposedly, because this is now a later report from January of this year. And here's what it says. It says, he's agreed to pay his estranged wife $2 million in temporary support. It doesn't say per month. It just says $2 million, but he's not going to pay the $5 million she wants for her divorce attorneys. Now, Matthew, this would be my incentive to go to law school, that I could just do one of these cases at $5 million and retire. What about you?
Well, let me put it to you this way. It sounds a lot more glamorous than it actually is. I happen to know both law firms that are on this case. Again, Dr. Dre's counsel is Laura Wasser and her firm. And his wife's counsel is Lisa Meyer's office, Meyer Olson, Helfand, and Myers, all very well-respected attorneys, and both very large firms with, I can't remember the count, but you're talking, dozens of lawyers working on a case like this. So when you hear a $5 million payday, it doesn't mean one lawyer is working and earning $5 million. It's probably a composite of a team of lawyers working around the clock at, a collective billable hour rate of, $10,000 an hour or something.
Collective.
Including staff and all.
I almost had a heart attack.
No. No lawyer can have the gall to bill that high. let's say you have 10 lawyers working on the case, which would be a lot, plus maybe three or four staff members. When you add up the collective hourly rate of those lawyers, it's possible it could reach that level.
All right, then we would need four cases to retire. So I would need four cases to retire.
These kind of cases are few and far between. Okay, this is the cream.
Not in Hollywood, really.
Because most of these cases settle amicably. They don't go through scorched earth litigation like you're seeing here. And the truth is, where lawyers make their money is in scorched earth litigation. That's really where we make all our money. So if things settle quietly and nicely, we don't make $5 million, And I've never come close to making $5 million, so.
You will, Matthew, just because you're so charming and knowledgeable, of course. But wait, it is a one-time payment for temporary support because their next hearing or trial date is in April.
Yeah, it's probably what we would call temporary, interim, unallocated spousal support subject to reallocation.
And right.
The fancy way of saying, hey, I'm going to throw a chunk of money at you, but I'm going to reserve my right to go back once we have more information and figure out what the right number should have been. And to the extent I overpaid you, I should get some sort of credit. To the extent I underpaid you, I'll owe you the difference. But for now, I'm going to give you this big pile of money.
And it ends with, because you had asked before, what kind of money problems do they have? It ends with, Dr. Dre will continue to cover Nicole's living expenses in this temporary time at the Malibu home, which is where the Beats deal started when Jimmy Iovine from Interscope Records was walking down the beach, because I did watch The Defiant Ones another 8,000 times. And that's where they came up with the headphones concept, the Beats headphones for Apple. But so pay Nicole's living expenses at the Malibu home, her mother's expenses at the Palisades home, but he will not, and here's where he drew the line, pay for her security costs.
Yeah.
That's how I wanted to end that.
Well, you can't blame him.
No, not at all.
Somewhere.
I know, you do have to draw the line in the Malibu beach sand. So now let's go to marital standard of living, spousal support, and division of assets. So can you please address what is the marital standard of living, and does it apply to both people?
Sure. Well, technically, it should apply to both people in the sense that it was this life that they created together. It really is a way of describing the way that a married couple conducted themselves during marriage, generally speaking, towards the end of marriage. how they lived, how much money they spent, what they did. Did they travel? Where did they live? Where did they go? Did their children go to private school? What kind of cars did they drive? Did they have domestic help? What kind of groceries did they buy? Did they get beauty treatments? Did they get plastic surgery? Did they go to the salon all of the time? Did they have personal trainers? You know, I mean, just the deep, really.
Well, yes to all of that.
The nitty gritty details of their life and really just boiling it down to like, why is this relevant in a divorce case? Is it gives a number, which is almost always calculated by a forensic accountant, that then is used to quantify the monthly amount that this lifestyle costs. And in doing that, then you can kind of figure out the lifestyle budget. And so really where it's the most relevant, generally speaking, is for the out spouse figuring out kind of what is their ceiling. Because if their lifestyle is X amount, it's really hard to go above that lifestyle. So the goal of the out spouse is to move it as high as it possibly can go. And then really what happens on the other end of that, the in-spouse, the payor, the one who's paying support, their goal is to minimize it. So what they generally do, for example, if you have somebody who is self-employed, their tactic is they're going to say, well, wait a second, you know, my ex is saying we spent all this money and crazy stuff, but look, at the end of the day, all we could spend are after-tax dollars. So our lifestyle is only my after-tax earnings. Okay. The difference being that if somebody can show, oh, we were running all this money on credit cards, oh, we were doing this, doing that, running it through the business versus him saying, okay, my after-tax bottom line is this amount. Now you have a spread that could be quite substantial.
Okay, but you know how I hear it normally, and you probably do too, depending on who you're representing. Let's sure. just say you're representing the lower wage earner.
Sure.
And the lower wage earner wants to live exactly the way they lived as a couple in one home. But the lower wage earner quite often wasn't working at all.
Right.
And so, you know, my thing is when I'm talking to people, well, the way you lived with all the money going into one home is going to be different when you have two homes.
Right.
So how do you explain to the lower wage earner, well, maybe not exactly the same way.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, if you're talking about just explaining it to them, I think the simplest way to do it, as I tell a lot of my clients, is you're going from one household to two households on the same source income. So it's just mathematically impossible to recreate 200% using 100% inflow. It just doesn't work. So you have to understand that regardless of what the law says, that's just reality. Because, yes. You know, this ties back into the permanent support thing, which is, you know, lifestyle, marital lifestyle, that's just one factor the judge has to weigh in accordance with the ability to pay, the income. So what you're saying is true. You know, let's say they spent $200,000 a month. If they don't have $400,000 of income, and I'm not even taking into account tax, I'm just saying $400,000 of income, there's no way that the person can pay $200,000 to their ex and then keep their $200,000. So that they both have an equal lifestyle. It's just mathematically impossible. So, you know, that's where the balance of the factors comes in under 4320. And, you know, I mean, it's true. I mean, unless the couple happened to like hit the lottery before getting divorced, their lifestyles are both going to go down. And that's just the reality. It's because you're dividing up an estate into two, you know.
Thank you. And I think sometimes, and I get it, everything's emotional.
Yeah.
The spouse that's the lower wage earner or non-wage earner might be really mad if they're not the ones who asked for the divorce, or right. if they asked for the divorce right. because of malfeasance of some
right.
sort
of
on the wage earner. And I'm just supposed to continue to live the way I was living. And it's a tough conversation to have.
It's a very tough conversation, and it's a tough pill to swallow. And I find you know, the higher in lifestyle and station in life people get, the harder it is for them to go back down, you know?
Yes.
It's really difficult.
Yes, and, you know, so we're in Los Angeles, and the entertainment industry is here, and that's where you have mega moguls everywhere, film, television, talent agencies and such. And you know, Matthew, when I was dealing with some of the film producers some years ago, when we had movies and theaters, it's very difficult for them to change. There's an ego involved, and there's just a taste for life that is almost impossible, and they will go into debt. They will sell their film royalties just to be able to drive the same car and live in the same neighborhood. And
right.
It is what it is.
What it is. And then, you know, the more they do that, the harder the crash is when it all comes apart.
Because it will at some point. Reality does take over, doesn't it?
Unfortunately. Well, you know, I mean, the entertainment business too, it's hard to have a long sustained career in that business. I mean, you know, the very lucky few have these multi-decade careers, but for many, they get this, they get some big hits, they get a lot of money flowing in, and it's hard to sustain that. And so, you know, classic Hollywood story, I guess.
Let's go to division of a business as an asset and embezzlement. So here's why I'm tying the two together.
Yeah.
So Nicole is being investigated, so allegations, right. I guess, right now, by the LAPD for allegedly embezzling from the company.
Right.
Dr. Dre's business partner, Larry Chapman, recently went to the police and filed a report claiming Nicole withdrew hundreds of thousands of dollars. Yeah. And I'm sorry, Nicole, I really don't mean to throw you under the bus. But
Allegedly.
Withdrew hundreds of thousands of dollars, but this does come into play with regular people too, from their business account without authorization because her name was on the account. And the amount of money, allegedly, was $385,000. So, A, is this business, can this business be community property, first of all?
Well, it depends on if they have a prenup or not. I mean, if they have a prenup, then most likely that's going to control unless somehow the prenup's overturned. But let's, for discussion purposes, assume they don't. Then yes, I mean, the business was, it was either created during marriage or even if it existed before marriage, there was growth during marriage by virtue of work efforts by one of the spouses. So that, either way, that creates a community property interest. So yes, I mean, there is, there is a community property interest. The million-dollar question, or in this case, probably like the $10 or $100 million question, is how do you value that interest, right? And so I'm sure they both, on both sides, have very good teams of forensic accountants that are very experienced in business valuation and tracing and certified fraud examination. And probably what happened was these transactions were caught by one of the forensic accountants, and now this is being used as leverage to try and push someone into settlement, because it's very unusual to go to the police. Frankly, the police probably don't have the same resources that these folks do as far as investigation goes. So I think it's unlikely. And you know, not to, to minimize the amount of money, but that amount of money in that size of an estate is fairly small, $385,000. Out of
everything being relative,
out of you know, 8 or 9 figure estate, however big it is. You know, it's probably being used as leverage realistically to try and get her to settle, because it sounds like it would be a breach of fiduciary duty and a misappropriation of community property funds by her. And you know, I mean, could she do it? If she was on the account, she certainly had the right to take the money, but what she did with it, if she, you know, moved it offshore or something like that, that's going to be a breach of fiduciary duty.
Yeah. So in regular land, non-celebrity land, when one party who really doesn't work in the business has access to a business account, along with maybe other joint bank accounts, once a divorce is filed for, don't laws go into effect that one person can't just take on their own? Doesn't there have to be open disclosure?
True, true. Those are called the Family Law Automatic Temporary Restraining Orders in California, or the Family Law ATROs, as we call them. And yes, those in theory prevent either spouse from, I think it's transferring, hypothecating, encumbering, selling, or otherwise disposing, I might be mincing my words, but of any assets, regardless whether they're personal, held in a business, community property, separate property. You're not supposed to do it, but there are exceptions, and one exception would be in the ordinary course of business, so the business can continue operating, or for the necessaries of life. So that's where it comes, you know, a little bit more into play. And you know, what would happen is if somebody's on the account, they're, according to the bank, they're allowed to take the money. So it's not like they're committing fraud if they're an account holder. But the question would be, well, what do they do with the money after they took it? And is that a breach of their fiduciary duties to their spouse or a breach of their duties owed to the company as an officer or a shareholder or whatever it might be? And then those may trigger different legal remedies.
And then just so people don't get nervous if this has happened, the listeners in their lives, any monies taken maybe out of turn can be justified in the settlement once everything's pulled together, right?
Generally speaking, yeah. I mean, generally speaking, you can figure that out. It's not the end of the world. I mean, obviously, if there was some sort of criminal element to it, like, for example, if she hacked into his bank and fraudulently... she
wasn't found the passwords, wasn't on the account, something like that.
Different story versus an account she's on title to, which she presumably has access to and permission to use. That's a different story, you know.
So, okay. Let's finish with that one lingering question that I think all of us get from our clients, and that is, I'm afraid to leave the house. We're not getting along. We know we're going to file for divorce, but all of my friends have told me that if I leave the house, I give up my interest in the house.
No.
True or not true?
No, not true at all. No, moving out of a house does not waiver, does not generally speaking waive any ownership right you may have in the house, unless you had a prenup or something that said that, which is highly unusual. No, what I think that the general misconception and why people would say that is, once you vacate the house, it's very hard to get back in. So, you know, you have to understand that once you're out, you're pretty much out until the case is resolved. And that's why people hang around. And that's why you have divorces where people are going through a divorce. I'll give you an example. Today, I was in a settlement conference by Zoom, and the couple are still living together, and they're doing this conference with a judge trying to settle their case in different rooms of the house. And so you know, we're doing a Zoom call, myself and the other lawyer, and then this couple who are on opposite ends of their house at the same time.
Oh my heavens.
And part of that is neither wants to give up the advantage of being in the house and also the advantage of being with the children, you know?
Oh, and that's interesting. I hadn't really thought about it that way. Now, okay, so to finish, because this is the last aspect of this divorce, but... and people go through it. So one person leaves the house, maybe things got heated. Okay, I just have to go, packs a suitcase, enough to get them by. But the bulk of their things are still there.
Yeah.
How and when can they get back in to get their things?
Well, I mean, it really depends on the circumstances of the case. The threshold question is there a restraining order in place preventing them from returning to the home or not? If there is, then they would only be able to come back with a court order. If there is not a restraining order, in theory, they have a right to access the home at any point. And then that question is, well, if the lock's been changed, do they have a key? But in theory, they would have the right to come back and get their belongings. But the act of moving out doesn't relinquish ownership of their belongings. They still have a right to prove that they're either their separate property from, say, maybe before the marriage, or something they inherited or got by a gift, or community property. So they wouldn't lose their rights, but they would be without their things probably until things are settled and resolved.
Well, that's it for these two divorces, Matthew. First of all, I know you're enormously busy.
I am.
And we got you just because you got a trial postponed a few weeks, right?
That's right, yes.
So we were lucky to have you, Matthew. How can people get in touch with you?
So they can go to my website. It's my last name, Smurda, S-M-U-R-D-A, law, L-A-W.com, smurdalaw.com. Or they can give me a call, 424-253-1177.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And you are going to come back, right?
Of course.
You are a standing member of this show.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And thank all of you listeners for attending the program. I hope you got a lot of value out of this, plus a little bit of enjoyment, a little left of center. You can reach me by going to the website for this podcast, amicabledivorceexpert.com. Thank you again, and I look forward to speaking with you next week.
That's our show for today.
Thank you for joining us. Be good to yourselves, be kind to your spouse, and cherish your children above all else.